Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Events are back. Coming up today, Western Growers is having its Tech Center open house in Salinas, and the Western Ag Processors Association meeting kicks off today in Monterey. But before all of that, JCS Marketing had its 2021 Virtual Almond Day on Tuesday. Several topics were discussed. Among them, Dr. Jalinda Rajal talked about managing stink bugs in almonds. Here is part of his presentation.
Lard bugs, part of that is we have multiple species of the native stink bug. This stink bug, one of the characteristics of this stink bug is that they have these sealed shape structure in the back, as you see. They are all in the same family called Pentatomidae. And then they, when they disturb, they release some kind of defensive spray or, you know, pungent smell, and that's what we call the stink bug. Four different species I saw here. I'll talk about little bit about each species in the slides, coming slides. So the green stink bug is one of the common one that we hear and may cause problem in almond orchard. It's about 3 by 4 inch of size. It's a, you know, big size bug, I would say, and has this yellow color lining on the abdomen, on the surrounding it, and the black dots on them. So that's the best way to identify the green stink bug. Of course, they are in green color. Euler stink bug, which is about the same size as the green stink bug, but more like a roundish body. And also in the green, as you see, there are spots on the all over its body that helps to identify in general that this is, you know, different than the green stink bug. Of course, there can be other similar looking stink bug maybe present in almond orchard too. I think I would say one of the things that in almond orchard that there has not been any sort of systematic evaluation or assessment of the all different kinds of bugs, what's present in the almond orchard. Most of these information that we have is generated in, could be in other crops like a pistachio or could be in the peaches and other things and kind of modified and use it in the almond system. So we may not have exactly the same species or, you know, could have the multiple species present in almond orchard. I think it's one of the important aspects is to identify all these different species of the stink bug in the orchard and at least you know, keep that as a part of the record. So one of the things that we're doing in coming years is exactly that, looking at the different species and identifying those and accurately identifying those is important aspect. Other really little smaller than that, stink bug species is red soldier stink bug. As you see here, the red soldier, but that may or may not be present all the times. And sometimes the color also varies. For example, here is a little more greenish. Other cases you see the brownish color. The one of the identifying characters is having this red color feet or, you know, at the end of this leg and tarsus region where you can see the red feet, sort of kind of reddish structure. That's the one of the identifying characteristic. They're also the very, they're also the smaller in size compared to green stink bug and Euler stink bug. Conspur stink bug is also about the same size as the red soldier. Has this dark spot all over their legs. That's the best identifying characteristic for this Conspur stink bug. There are also some of the predatory stink bug present. For example, rough stink bug, very, very common in tree nuts, tree fruit orchard. And many times we get confused with the, you know, BMSP, brown marmorated stink bug, or any other species of the stink bug as well. But the one of the important characteristic is that in the mouth part, they have this like a tooth-like structure, and that helps to identify this is a rough stink bug and this is a predatory one. Also, the spine shoulder stink bug may be present in almond orchard as well. Okay, so we talked about the general, you know, the four different species of these stink bug, native stink bug present in almond orchard. But now if we discuss a little bit more about the, you know, their biology. So in general, all of these stink bugs, they overwinter. They're known to overwinter in the woods or, you know, wooded area near to the orchard. Not necessarily inside the orchard, but closer to the orchard. So whenever they overwinter as an adult and there in the springtime or even later in the summer, they move into the orchard and cause damage. So these stink bugs are migrating into the almond orchard. It's of course the problem. And the native stink bug feeding in the summertime, whenever they're present in the orchard, is not known to cause significant nut drop because they are sort of like a latecomer in terms of going into the orchard. So at that time, the fruits are already, you know, big enough in size, and even though they produce the gummings on the fruit, that may also not result in a damage to the kernel. That's another thing. So one thing that they don't do the significant nut drop. The other thing is that even though they feed on the fruit, they may produce the gummosis, but may not penetrate and cause damage to the nut meat. So those are the things that we need to be careful. Seeing the stink bug or native stink bug right there in the almond orchard doesn't mean that it caused economic damage. All of these stink bug, native stink bug, leaf-footed bug, they produce a more or less similar symptom on the fruit, the gumming fruit, and it's really difficult to identify which species is causing a problem. It's more like a timing of the infestation is more important criteria than really looking at this damaged fruit. Timing and identifying or finding the actual bug in the orchard is more important. Large monitoring, the large bugs, like all together monitoring. We don't have any reliable traps yet to date. And also there is no treatment threshold for these leaf-footed bug as well as the stink bug. Early season infestation by the leaf-footed bug, it's often at least one time the insecticide spray, but they're nymphal stage, and then the second generation, third generation of the leaf-footed bug later in the season are not known to cause significant economic damage. So the one that is coming out from the overwintering going into the young fruit is the one that caused significant damage. And adults are the one that caused significant damage, not nymph. And we also know that when spraying for the leaf-footed bug, early part of the season, especially with some of the broad spectrum insecticide, which are effective to control them, that can disrupt the mite predators and other natural enemies into the orchard system. So we need to be careful in that regard too, in terms of selecting what to use. Here is the UCIPM guidelines, the mention of some of the insecticide in here. Bifenthrin, lambda cyhalothrin, clothianidin. These are the three listed in under that. So as we know, if we use these pyrethroids, as I mentioned, that there might have some, you know, the secondary pest outbreak or at least the killing of some of the predators out there and cause another issue. So we need to be make sure that, you know, the level of the infestation, what we're seeing is justifiable to use these insecticide for the control. Now, next couple of minutes, I would like to talk about the new invasive insect, the brown marmorated stink bug. Native stink bug, these other information you can also find in the UCIPM guidelines and other places, but this is a new pest and it's becoming a more and more problem in the valley, and especially in the almonds. So I wanna take this opportunity to talk about this insect in here. Again, the identification part for BMSB versus the similar looking stink bug, which are the rough stink bug and conspirator stink bug here. The main distinct characteristic is that BMSB has these two white bands on the antenna, which are lacking in conspers as well as rough stinger. That's the best way to identify BMSP compared to these other species.
That full presentation and others are available online. Head to the West Coast Nut Growers Guide website for more information. Our news brief is up next. We'll be right back.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R almond, grizzly walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and platinum clonal pistachio rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Here's your news brief for today. Colorado lawmakers have approved a major expansion of rights for the state's 40,000 agricultural workers. The Colorado Sun says the state's governor is eager to sign off on the legislation. Colorado Senate Bill 87 gives farm workers the right to join labor unions, earn state minimum wage, and overtime pay. Colorado's Labor Peace Act currently exempts agriculture workers from job protections, such as the collective bargaining that's available to workers in other industries. This bill eliminates that exemption and opens the door for agricultural workers to organize and join labor unions, engage in collective bargaining, and hold strikes. Condition ratings for spring wheat this week are less than half what they were at the same time last year. Stephanie Ho has more.
The news about spring wheat condition is not good.
I wish I had good news on spring wheat condition, but I do not. Only 37% of the crop good to excellent, 27% very poor to poor. It's a decline slightly from last week's condition, 38% and 25% respectively.
That was USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
It's a decline slightly from last week's condition, 38% and 25% respectively, and a dramatic drop from last year's 81% good to excellent, just 2% very poor to poor.
He points to where some of the poorest conditions are.
Washington State leads the country in very poor to poor ratings for spring wheat. 62% of the crop in those two categories as of June 13th.
Meanwhile, only 4% of the nation's spring wheat has been harvested, which is well behind the five-year average of 15%. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The USDA is set to begin issuing more than $1 billion in payments over the next several weeks, beginning today. The funds are for agricultural producers with approved applications for the Quality Loss Adjustment, or QLA, program, and producers who have already received payments through the Wildfire and Hurricane Indemnity Program Plus, or WIP Plus. Producers weathered significant natural disasters during the 2018 and 2019 years, and the programs provide disaster assistance to those producers who suffered losses. For each crop year, the maximum amount that a person or legal entity may receive under the QLA program, directly or indirectly, is $125,000. USDA made adjustments to the domestic corn supply and demand ledgers for the marketing year, resulting in a forecast of tighter supplies. Here's Rod Bain.
Two notable changes are reported in USDA's latest look at domestic corn supply and demand estimates for the current marketing year.
One, we increased our corn used for ethanol forecast by 75 million bushels.
Based on returning ethanol use to pre-COVID levels, according to World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekinowski.
We also raised our export forecast for this back year by 75 million bushels.
Reflecting a strong export pace and a tightening of Brazil's corn supplies.
That adds up to 150 million bushel increase in total use, which reduces ending stocks by the same amount.
Carrying in less bushels in beginning stocks and tightening ending stocks for the 2021-22 U.S. corn balance sheet.
And we made no changes to price this month for either year.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley joined a fellow Republican, Mike Rounds of South Dakota, and John Tester, a Montana Democrat, in introducing legislation on meatpacking. The bill would address the anti-competitive practices in the meat and poultry industries that threaten the nation's food supply and national security. The legislation comes on the heels of a recent ransomware attack on JBS, one of the country's largest meat suppliers. Grassley says food security is national security. The senator's bill, called the Meatpacking Special Investigator Act, would create the Office of the Special Investigator for Competitive Matters within the USDA's Packers and Stockyards Division. The new investigator would oversee a team of investigators with subpoena power dedicated to preventing and addressing anti-competitive practices in the meat and poultry industries and enforcing the nation's antitrust laws. That's your news brief for today. Now, coming up next, Taylor Chalstrom is talking with a UC Farm Advisor on managing fusarium wilt in strawberries. If you'd like to read an article on that, that is the topic of my article in this month's Organic Farmer magazine. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Today, we're talking with Mark Bolda, UCCE Strawberry and Caneberry Farm Advisor in Santa Cruz County, about the challenges of managing fusarium in strawberries. Welcome, Mark.
Yeah, good afternoon, Taylor. It's good to be on.
Yeah, great to have you here, Mark. Mark, fusarium is a challenging pathogen for strawberry growers. You know, how does it affect the plant and what threat does it really pose for growers?
Okay. It does, and as I get into this, I do want to clarify, because this has been a point of confusion. When we're talking about fusarium wilt in strawberries, we are talking about a very specific type of fusarium, and this fusarium is not only just fusarium. Fusarium is the genus. The species is Oxysprum, but then for strawberries, we have what's known as a form species, and that's Fragaria. So when people take soil samples into lab and are looking for this pathogen, they have to be aware that if the lab sends back something that says they have fusarium, that's not going to be useful, and neither will be analysis which comes back for fusarium oxysprum. Both of those are going to be, they're going to give you false information. They're going to tell you information that you do not need. You need to get it down to forma specialis. And there are several laboratories in this area. The public laboratories, for example, at UC Davis, we work together with Akif Escalon, and there are also some private labs as well. So that being said, with this particular form species of fusarium, we have been having problems, I think, over the last 3 to 4 years, and it has been expanding rather quickly. Some people have said this is an association with the ban on methyl bromide. I'm not so sure, because I know some fields that have been fumigated now with methyl bromide because they have an exemption for research, or if the nurseries don't have the fusarium. But so if they have an exemption for experimental use or something like that, and they're still getting fusarium. So this is a very worrying trend.
I'm curious, for some of those other fusarium types, I know you say that only one of them is really of concern to strawberry growers, but if they do have some of those other fusarium types, do they need to manage those at all? Is it actually of any concern to them?
No, it's not. But remember, because there's many, many different types of fusaria, right? It must number in the thousands. So rather than getting what we would say is kind of a false positive, you really need to nail it down, because otherwise you're paying for something and it's not useful to you. So just getting the fusarium, okay, let's put it this way. Let's rank it. Maybe you should be concerned a tenth of a single percent, because it may be, right? So no, I would, just a general analysis that says you have fusarium, it's not going to be useful. I would not use that as a decision-making tool. Let's put it that way.
Mark, what methods do organic and conventional strawberry growers have to treat fusarium, specifically the one that affects strawberries?
So let's start with a conventional. Some of them overlap. A conventional, you know, we do not use methyl bromide anymore in conventional production here in the lower part of California. But we do now count with chlorpicrin. And chlorpicrin was always, when methyl bromide was used, chlorpicrin was used together with it. That's actually the thing that's doing the heavy lifting on the pathogens anyway. The problem is we don't get the distribution that we previously enjoyed with methyl bromide. So it is becoming a little harder, but on the conventional side, that is what people are doing. And then myself and the USDA scientist who specializes in these soil pathogens of strawberries, Peter Henry, we did some nice work looking at what's known as crop termination, which basically, since we know that a large majority of the specific fusarium to strawberries is found in the crown and within the plant, if we kill the plant at the end of the season very quickly, using, in our experiments, we use something known as KPEM, that's sodium potassium, is that we can knock that disease down. And then we go ahead and do the fumigation with our chlorpicrin. So we've added another fumigant. Unfortunately, KPEM is also very effective against weeds. So that's helpful there. Also with conventional growers, many of them are turning to this now because the chlorpicrin is not actually doing the whole job. It's better than doing nothing, but you're still seeing a lot of dying plants. Boy, I was just in a grower field last week, and it's, you know, he's very concerned. He's got dying plants. He did it by the book. He used the maximum rate of chlorpicrin. What should you do? There's really nothing you can do in season. We need to understand that, you know, there's not saying you can bubble through the tape or something like that. It's over. Your decisions have to be made at planting. And fortunately, in the case of fusarium, we do have many varieties that are resistant to the disease. So you plant them, and even though you have this special form of fusarium, the plants do fine. They're going to do better if you fumigate, but they do fine because they're resistant. Several of our proprietary lines of varieties, they are resistant, all of them. Within the University of California line of varieties, I would say maybe between 50 and 70% of our varieties are resistant. Unfortunately, when you know it, the ones that are really tasty and really productive are not. So we've got people still growing the susceptibles. Just do know if you have susceptible varieties, you may suffer loss. And then again, this corresponds to conventional growers too, is crop rotation. Rotate away from strawberries. If the amount of fusarium is low, maybe you get away with a two-year rotation. If you have a lot, I don't know how long it's going to be. We had a grower rotate away from strawberries for 3 or 4 years, and he still has a ton of it. So going to the organic, obviously you don't have fumigants, but organic, you can use your resistant varieties. And then also your crop rotation can be useful in organic. We should note that the specific form of fusarium that kills strawberries also can grow on other stuff. Not very well, but it can bridge over. Okay, it's not going to kill other things, you know, like say you put in celery or something like that. It's going to grow on that. Not very much. And the population will decline. It'll just decline slower than if it didn't have anything. Okay? But we should note that there is no chemical sort of solution to organics. So growers do need to recur to rotation and resistant varieties.
And yeah, because there's no chemical solution, that means that kind of crop termination method you were talking about is not viable for organic growers.
Not viable for organic, no.
Mark, in an article for Organic Farmer magazine, you mentioned research that is being conducted to look at the effects of soil temperature on fusarium.
Oh, yeah, right.
And, you know, how can organic strawberry growers change the temperatures of their soil potentially to affect the development of fusarium on strawberry?
Okay, so I think, so there's a couple things going on. It is known that fusarium in general likes warmer soil. So our soils here, you know, they're around 65, 68 degrees through, and you know, soil's buffered. It doesn't bounce up and down like the outdoor temperatures. But you can manage those soil temperatures by using different color plastic, right? So if you have a clear plastic, no one uses clear, but I'm doing this for the example, you have a greenhouse effect and the soil is much warmer. You know, it's not hugely warmer. I mean, you're probably looking at a difference, maybe 5, you know, top of that might be 10 degrees. Black plastic, again, absorbing light and it's absorbing heat. Now, if you go to a lighter plastic, say some of the dull silvers or white, those will definitely keep the soil cooler. But you should understand, and this is why we're doing this, myself, again, working in collaboration with Peter Henry from USDA, is actually testing those plastics side by side, because a cooler soil is also going to result in a plant that grows differently. The plant will grow slower. Now, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get less fruit. It's just going to mean you're going to have fruit at different times of the year than you would if you got a warmer plastic. But yeah, the cooler plastic, and let's all understand here too, is that using a cooler plastic doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to avoid having disease at all. It just means you're going to have less. And we're looking at all of this. I mean, we have seen it in grower fields that people have used silver plastic, you know, next to a darker plastic, they have less disease. But we really should, then that's what we do. We're going to subject it to scientific methods and then ascertain that that's indeed the case. And we're measuring the soil temperature, everything. It'll be a really nice package. It's 3 different locations across the Central Coast.
And so, you know, lowering that soil temperature, it's not necessarily an eradication or maybe even a prevention method. It's just kind of a reduction of Correct. The disease. And it kind of, you know, it can save money on maybe the overall treatment of the disease or help too.
Well, and absolutely. And thanks for bringing that up, Taylor, because it's very true. It's not going to eradicate, you know, or just completely save the plants. But when used in, and that's what we've been pushing the last 5 years, we need to take on an integrated approach for managing these soil pathogens in strawberries. It used to be methyl bromide chlorpicrin, one and done, and you're good. Now it's going to have to be a combination of resistant varieties, crop rotation, and the plastic. And with each one of these, you're getting a little bit less loss in fruit. That's the approach that we need to take. We're not going to be able to eradicate this pathogen. We need to live with it. And, you know, do the best we can, even though it's in the soil. That's right. That's exactly it.
Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah. Thanks for the question.
Yeah. That IPM approach is super important. We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Just a little bit of background, this insect, this stink bug species was found in the East Coast. It is, of course, the invasive species in late 1990s. And from that point, we're seeing, well, even though they were finding it and at that time, we start hearing about the BMSP all the time since 2010 when the BMSP caused significant economic damage on apple and peaches and throughout that mid-Atlantic region. A lot of different host plants, more than 170. And these bugs are very known to overwinter outside of the orchard, but more mostly on the structure, like the people's houses and shops and wood piles and all of those structure during the winter time. So as soon as they wake up in the spring, you know, temperature warms up, move into the orchard and cause damage. So this is just a map of the BMSP distribution in the US. I'm not going to talk too much about it, but the red is really bad. And the orange color is sort of medium tier. So we are in that category to date. Oregon is already moved up to that, you know, really that severe agriculture as well as nuisance issue sort of category of these state. So in the story of BMSP, again, I'm not going to talk about too much of this, but in general, even though BMSP was present in the Southern California in early 2000, but really after the 2013, when we see BMSP population is exploded pretty much in the fall in the Sacramento and downtown Midtown, and that's the population start moving up and down in the valley from that point, from Sacramento. We're seeing BMSP reproducing population in northern San Joaquin Valley in Spencer County in 2016 and 17, causing damage to the peaches and then almonds. In 2018, 19, 20, 21, we're seeing the increased infestation of these into the orchard. And very recently, we found the BMSP present in almond orchard in Fresno County area also. So they can cause pretty significant, they are spreading slowly, but there are the more and more places that we're finding the BMSP activity. These are some of the picture of BMSP in almond fruit causing. They also similar to leaf footed bug, they cause, when they feed on, they cause a significant nut drop. As you see in this picture and on the right, you can see in some cases, this is a control study that we did. But you know they are capable of doing pretty significant nut drop because of their feeding. Again, in general, you see the same thing in the leaf-footed bug and other stink bug. The feeding type of the symptom is more or less similar, having gummings. And when you cut the fruit, you can see this water-soaked spot. Sometimes the gummings on the nut meat on there, and then also the necrotic spot on the hull. And that kind of thing. And at the harvest, when we validated these infested nut, we found pretty much, throughout the season, they could do damage to nut meat. So this is what the BMSP damage look like at a different time of the year when you evaluate the fruit at harvest. So this is sort of like a BMSP presence in various different orchards in northern San Joaquin Valley. I know that I don't have too much time to go through in detail, but it's the more idea is that they're spreading. Their number is up and down in different years, but they are spreading and we're finding in more and more orchards. One thing that I want to point out is that when you looked at the seasonal presence, so this is very early part of the season, we see this overwintering adults. We see that the first generation adult we see around the middle of the summer in like July. And then at the end, early fall or late summer, we're seeing the second generation of the adults in the traps.
Our news brief is up next. We'll be right back. Again, if you'd like to read about managing fusarium, that's my article in this month's Organic Farmer magazine. That's our show for today. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS marketing team, thanks for listening.